You're listening to RTHK.
Good morning and welcome to Bank Chat. I'm Hugh Tiverton.
And I'm Nick Beecroft. In the first part of today's programme, we're talking about the International Baccalaureate and asking whether it's destined to end in tears.
The ESF has hailed its decision to switch to the IB after two-thirds of the first group of pupils across all its schools scored 30 points or more. Although the ESF pass rate is above the world average, it may not be enough for students to enter the universities of their choice.
Parents are worried that universities do not understand the IB and its points system. Three elite direct subsidy schools are scrapping or shelving plans to move to the IB. So what is the right way forward?
Give us a call with your thoughts, 233-88266, or email backchat@rthk.org.hk. That's backchat@rthk.org.hk. Or visit our Facebook page, Backchat on RTHK Radio. And after nine today, road racing on our streets. What's the solution? And joining us for our first discussion this morning, we have John Switzer, who's head of regional development with the IBO, the International Baccalaureate Organisation, based in Singapore. And in our central studio, Stephen Codrington, who's principal of Li Po Chun United World College. We did try our hardest to get the ESF to join the conversation, but they were not willing to join us this morning.
Stephen Codrington, what is IB? What is the International Baccalaureate? And what sort of makes it so different from for British parents or parents here in Hong Kong who are used to the GCSE or GCE A levels? What's the difference between A levels and IB?
Okay, there's a lot of questions there. The IB began back in the late 1960s as an alternative to A levels and to other qualifications. Initially to provide what was called a passport to universities around the world, the idea being that internationally mobile students or students who wanted to go to a university away from their home country needed a qualification that would be accepted globally. The IB was the result of that. It's since expanded, and in fact the majority of schools that teach the IB are no longer international schools worldwide, but national schools that are seeing it as a great way of curriculum improvement.
It's a lot different, is it not, to A-levels? I mean, when children who are aged between 16 and 18, they tend to sit down and they take three A-levels. They take this here, an AS sure. Or a couple of AS, and then they're three A-levels. The IB demands a lot more than that, does it not?
Yeah, I would describe it as different rather than more. The IB tries to give a balance between breadth and depth. IB students have to study six subjects rather than three, but three of them are done at what is called higher level, which is the kind of depth that's done in A levels, but the other three are done at standard level, which is giving the student an exposure to the subject without necessarily having to get into the great depth.
And within the, certainly within the higher level subjects, there's a great deal of coursework, essay work, a lot of writing, a lot more than in A levels.
Again, I think the key point is that it's different. It's not so much a difference in the amount of work, but the type of work. The A-level emphasizes rote learning in a way that the IB does not emphasize. The IB is based on discussion, debate, conceptual understanding, the contention of ideas. It's a more creative and in some ways, I suppose, a higher level of learning than what is expected from A-levels.
So that's an interesting point that you're making now, that it is a higher level of learning than A-levels, probably more demanding, therefore, more taxing for the child.
Depends on the child. I think the point is that in education, very seldom do you get a one-size-fits-all solution. I think A-levels do suit some students for whom the rote learning approach is something that they're very comfortable with. For students, though, that are interested in understanding things at a deeper level and perhaps trying to forge the link between different subjects and come up with the kind of creative solutions that I hear employers demanding these days, then I think for that type of thinking, the IB is better.
Is that why you're committed to IB? Why your school has always been, as far as I know, committed to IB?
Yeah, our school opened in 1992, and it's always used the International Baccalaureate. I think there are two broad reasons. One is The practical reason, we have students from almost 80 different countries, and therefore to have a qualification that is accepted globally and in many countries advantaged compared with local programs is it's almost a no-brainer for us. But the other is that philosophical approach. We're trying to prepare students for the kind of world that they will enter, not the kind of world of a generation ago. And increasingly, the demands of the world that we are preparing students for, I believe, are ones that where we need those creative solutions, trying to draw the links between different subjects in a way that I don't believe A-levels were ever designed to be able to achieve.
We had a couple of reactions for and against IB. Do give us an email, backchat@rthk.org.hk. If you've studied IB, if you've been teaching IB, if your children are involved in this discussion. Betty, in a message, says, A-levels are much better than IB if you actually know what you want to do. IB doesn't allow you to take all sciences. For people who want to do something like doctor, it's just ridiculous. Whereas Katie says, IB, I personally loved it. It's great. John Switzer is head of IBO Regional Development. He's joined us on the line now. Mr. Switzer, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Yeah, thanks for joining us. Regional Development, how's that going? What sort of take-up is there of IB now in the area?
Well, we've always had good growth, and each year we tend to grow something like 20% per year, so throughout the region and the world, actually. So this year we have 27 different countries in Asia-Pacific that are doing one of the three IB programs. You know, Dr. Codrington talked a lot about the diploma, and that's, I'm sure, a lot of what the interest is in Hong Kong right now with the schools that are taking it on. But we do offer three programs, primary years, middle years, and the diploma program, and all three of them are growing at a great speed throughout the world and here in Asia. And again, as Dr. Codrington mentioned, we have a lot of state schools now that are interested. And at the outset, when the IB was being developed, it was clearly identified for a group of students who were globally mobile, particularly in Europe, in International School of Geneva, which was one of the founding IB schools. But throughout the world now, we have a lot of these migration issues where students are in one country, but it might not be the country of their passport. And so in Asia now, we see quite a bit of that. We have just under 300 schools now, which are our diploma schools. I think the number today is 282, 14 of which are in Hong Kong. So the growth is quite good, and we're supporting that as much as possible. We don't drive it. We don't advertise. I don't go around and tell schools that, you know, you need to become a school that offers the IB. Schools come to us, and that's something that we've been very proud of, and we are maintaining that.
Is one of the problems, though, the schools which adopt IB, many of them adopt IB for the 16 to 18-year-olds, but they have not adopted the middle-year programs or the PYP programs, and therefore children are doing GCSEs, for example, and then are thrust into the IB. Would it not be a lot better if these schools introduced IB earlier into their middle years?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the distinctions that we need to make is that the primary years program and the middle years programs, the two programs that could lead to the IB diploma, they're frameworks instead of curriculum. So the IGCSE that you mentioned, that's a curriculum. The IB diploma is a curriculum. But the PYP and MYP are frameworks. And within that framework, schools are able to offer whatever curriculum they feel helps fit in with that. Now, that could be for national reasons, or it could be that they are still using the IGCSE. So it's not that schools couldn't do the IGCSE with the IB, MYP. It's just that they may not choose to.
But the style of learning, would it not be better for IB students, diploma students, to have done the MYP program?
Well, realistically, I think, you know, again, as Dr. Codrington alluded to, it's the type of learning that you're trying to foster in the school.
Yes, so, my point, yeah.
Yeah, so it seems to me that the kind of students that will be very successful in programs like the IB diploma are those that are willing to learn, willing willing to think, you know, we have a learner profile about some of the attributes, 10 attributes that we see in the IB, and those are throughout the school, throughout the teaching community, pedagogy and how students learn and how teachers are able to bring out that learning in students is critical in all of this. We can talk a lot about curriculum and we can talk a lot about assessment, but clearly the quality schools are those schools where the teaching dynamic is such that it's something that can be supported by our mission and our learner profile.
A message from John who asks, why is it great? What gets me is that there isn't a choice. What schools do the A-level system here in Hong Kong now? If I went back to the UK now, my oldest would have a very hard time getting into the local school system over there because of a lack of knowledge in individual sciences and so on. I would like to ask, what age of the child does the IB system diverge with depth of knowledge from the A-level system? Are they comparable up to GCSE level age? Anyone help?
Well, I think, again, my point there on the GCSE or IGCSE that's often found in international schools is that that's an actual curriculum. And so it's acceptable. Some schools do it where they offer the GCSE alongside the MYP framework. So as far as depth of knowledge, there are lots of subjects in the framework that allows for depth of knowledge. Clearly, though, when you're talking the IB diploma, as Dr. Codrington mentioned, you know, you've got three subjects that have to be studied at a fairly high depth. You could do two sciences in those, and some schools allow students to do, say, three sciences, but they would have to do one of them outside of the diploma. It becomes quite difficult when you are studying at that depth, three hard sciences. Same with the math program. We have different levels of math. Those that are studied at the highest level are extremely difficult, comparable in many cases to what students would be expected of in first year university throughout the world.
Could I just make a comment also on the question that came in? The assumption behind that is that the reason you study something is to acquire knowledge. That was the assumption of the question. For most students, the knowledge that they learn at school is going to be out of date 5 years after they leave the school. The important thing for students to learn are the skills, the methodology, and the concepts, because those are the things that will stand by students for the rest of their life. To me, that's the benefit of the IB, because it emphasizes those skills.
Is your knowledge really out of date? Depends what you're studying, doesn't it? If you're doing history?
It can do, but I mean, even a subject like history, I think the interpretations and the way that things are studied do move on. The point of any study in school, I think, is to prepare a student for a process of lifelong learning. It's not like you graduate from school and you suddenly say, I've got all the knowledge I'm going to have for the rest of my life. I need to make the most of it.
Mr. Schweitzer, can we now turn to the acceptance of the IB by universities? If I can just concentrate on British universities at this point, because there's been a lot of controversy in Britain about IB results and the acceptance by British universities. Now, I'm sure it's accepted that British universities like the IB. In our research talked to some admissions tutors, and they've told us how much they prefer the IB to the A levels. But the problem seems to be coming out of Britain since this last wave of results is that the acceptance level by the universities of IB is very high. There are stories now in the Quality British newspapers saying that many, many pupils who take IB are not able to get into the university of their choice, and that the IB is asking for far too many points when compared to A-level offers. For example, an A and two Bs can be 34 IB points. Three Bs can be 32 IB points, which to students seems to be extremely high. Can you give us your take on this controversy?
Well, I think one of the challenges, obviously, is trying to compare apples with apples. And the A levels that have three subjects graded from, you know, A to E have always tried. It's very difficult to make these apples and apples comparisons between the IB diploma. You know, again, as Dr. Codrington mentioned, the IB is looking much more about whole development of the child and attributes such as lifelong learning and the six subjects plus an additional 4,000 word extended essay plus 150 hours of some sort of community service involvement plus a course called Theory of Knowledge, and all of that combined gives a diploma score which is out of 45. So as you are probably aware and your listeners are probably aware, that the UCAS tariff has been developed to try and make some comparisons between the IB and the A-level system, and it's quite difficult to do that when you're comparing three subjects, which are difficult and in great depth, against six subjects plus those three additional components. So the universities individually have been working to try and devise some sort of way of equating the IB diploma against the typical and more common in the UK A-level offers. So that this is a very big challenge. The tariff is one purported solution. Again, the challenge here is that universities don't, in the UK, don't necessarily need to use the tariff. So on the one hand, you've got something on paper that says, well, this looks like it's compared to this, but then you have the universities themselves and individual admission tutors and departments deciding on what those offers will be. The offers haven't changed much for the IB. I think it's just the quantity of people that are applying now makes those precious places so much more difficult to get.
But the crux of the problem really, is it not, that as you're saying, the points may not have changed, but the trouble is if they're asking for two A's and a B, which would be about 320 odd UCAS points, they're actually asking for 34 IB points, which is something like five A's at A level. You're not comparing like with like. The university is asking for two A's and a B, but 34, 35 points, which actually is about five A's at A level. So those students who are taking IB are being hard done by, are they not? They're easier for them just to have taken three A levels.
Well, I guess it comes down to what is the purpose of completing the IB diploma, and if the purpose is solely to gain admission into a certain university, then it's a difficult question.
Well, no, surely it is though. Surely the point is you're taking this education between the ages of 16 and 18 to get to university.
Well, most of the students do actually go on to university. That is true, but again, you know, there are other ways of gaining admission to universities, and so, given the quantity of universities around the world and the numbers of students now that are entering into tertiary education globally, there are challenges for every system, whether it's the IB or the A-level, to actually find enough seats for these students.
But do you think that the British universities are getting it right, or are they getting it wrong? If they're getting it wrong, is there anything you can do about it?
Well, I think it's a formative process. You know, the very first university that recognized the IB was Oxford University. So I think for a long time now, since the early 70s, universities in the UK have known about the IB and have actually said that they enjoy it. And as you've mentioned from some of the university admission tutors, they are quite happy with the students that are coming in. Again, it has to do with their preparation, their inquisitive nature, their curious problem-solving methodology, the way they like to think about solutions
but
to problems.
But maybe they're just happy because they're getting the very cream of the cream.
Hugh, if I could make a comment from a head of school's point of view, we prepare students for about a dozen, universities in about a dozen different countries around the world. Our consistent experience is that the IB is definitely no disadvantage to get into university, and it is a huge advantage for the students once they get there because of the kind of preparation that they've been through.
I think you're quite right, Mr. Codrington, for the research we've done in the office here, that universities do prefer the IB because it helps those students are much better equipped, as you say, to study in university. They're used to writing 4,000-word essays, for example, research and investigation. I don't think that's the problem. I think the problem is for parents at the moment is that their children are finding it difficult to get into universities of their choice, because the IB points demanded by the universities are so high, they don't equate with two A's and a B, let's say, which Edinburgh University may offer for a history course.
I think it varies quite a bit from country to country. I mean, one of the debates I know in Australia is at the moment is that are the IB students advantaged, not disadvantaged, compared with other students? If you look at entry into the many universities in the US, a student coming in with the IB will often be given advanced standing. They don't even have to study first year. They go straight into second year. So I think that there is a big variation from country to country. I suspect that some of the issues that you're talking about with the British universities may be that uncomfortable phase that many countries go through as they get used to and come to understand the nature of the IB. You often get a conservatism during that transitional phase.
But if somebody is planning to go to university in the UK,
Mr. Coddington, would your advice be then don't do IB?
No, without question I would say do the IB, because as I say, in our experience, we have students every year going to Oxford, Cambridge, many of the different British universities. I have no doubt whatsoever that the IB is no disadvantage. It may even be an advantage in the interview because of the kind of experiences that it gives compared with A-level students.
Okay, just some more feedback. Anger says, in my experience in IBO schools, IB is certainly not for everyone. It's great for leaders and self-motivated students who are undergoing an education, as opposed to the general run-of-the-mill student who are trained to pass exams. You may not be aware, but the US education system has been designed to train rather than educate for a couple of generations now. IB is not only better, it's the only one to truly provide an education. That thought comes from Angus. And Ellie says, as a parent of a student just starting her IB diploma and one doing the MVP?
MYP.
I'm very pleased that my children have the chance to study IB. Yes, it's more demanding, but it encourages thinking and problem solving, something that will give them a huge advantage in any future endeavour they choose to follow. The A-levels would have been a useless qualification for my children should they return to Australia. As far as straight sciences, personally, coming from a medical family, I'd prefer to be seen by a doctor who has both personal skills and scientific skills, not someone who would prefer to disengage the patients. Disengage from the patients as human beings. Ellie, thanks very much for that. And Chris says, I believe Kellett School, the British International School in Hong Kong, is one of the only schools set up for A and O levels. IB is good, but it does limit uni entry in the UK. This is especially true if you are not academic and you do the diploma. It just doesn't carry the same weight. It appears to me the IB is suitable for a certain type of learner rather than all learners.
Is that also a problem, Mr. Coddington, that there's no choice in the schools and the, let's say, the ESF schools in Hong Kong? It's all IB, and IB is so academically demanding or a different learning experience. Do you think there should be an alternative to IB in secondary schools? And secondly, I'd just like to get your opinion on whether the MYP should definitely be taught as a prelude, as a way of introducing children to the IB diploma.
Okay, two questions. If I had to have only one course for the senior secondary students in a school, I'd say the IB would without question be my choice. And I say that not only as a teacher, but as a father whose four children have all done the IB. I've seen firsthand the effect it has. I think the IB is something which is actually accessible to all students or students of all ability, but it also gives the gifted students a chance to display the giftedness. In answer to your question, would it be better to do MYP? Frankly, I don't think it makes any difference at all. As John said, it's a framework rather than a curriculum. We get students from almost 80 different countries. It's not a choice of GCSE or MYP or Hong Kong certificate. It's a choice of the most obscure educational programs you could imagine in third world countries. The IB diploma has no prerequisite, and so it actually doesn't matter what courses people have done before, in the sense that the IB diploma is designed to bridge the gap between any program prior to the IB and the IB itself.
John Switzer, I think Coddington, Ms. Coddington, Dr. Coddington, talking about the sort of honeymoon period for British universities and the IB. How are you, or can you at the IBO somehow talk to British universities? Is it time now to really set British universities straight and produce a proper guideline for the points table?
Well, about 7 years ago, we went around to most of the UK universities and asked them what they thought about the IB. And through that that exercise, that opened a lot of eyes about kind of the students that they're looking for. And sometimes it's anecdotal, to put a policy on the webpage about what you will do for the IB, although it's very helpful for students. Sometimes you hear things from the admission tutor saying what they like and what they don't like. And so we've replicated that study in Australia and New Zealand amongst the universities there. But we do have a person whose job is to work with universities. He's the university liaison officer for the IB, and he works in the UK. He was a former coordinator at a very strong IB school in Oxford. So he's very well equipped to be the contact person. We, just a few months ago, had a conference in Hong Kong where we brought in all of these people in around the world who work with university recognition, and we went through it and we talked about some of the issues. And so from that, I think, we're working towards working with universities in different parts of the world. It's a big challenge, obviously, you know, with the quantity of universities.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. We've run out of time. We've got a break for the news now at 9 o'clock. We've got a couple more comments on IB, which will air after the news at 9. We're also going to be talking about road racing in Hong Kong. The forecast fine and very hot today. 29 Celsius at the moment, relative humidity is at 80%. Back with more in 5 minutes' time. Welcome back to Backchat this morning with me, Hugh Tiverton, and Nick Beecroft. Very kindly, our two guests from the first part of the programme this morning talking about IB have agreed to stay on for a little while. Thank you very much indeed to Stephen Codrington, who's the principal of the local Li Po Chun United World College, and John Switzer on the line from Singapore. He's head of regional development with the IBO, the International Baccalaureate organisation. We've had some more emails and response that we'd like to get through as well from JR, for example, who says, before the IB system was introduced, shouldn't there have been discussion with the UK universities to agree guidelines for them to accept IB students? JL also addresses the ESF, the English Schools Foundation. JL says, I am tremendously disappointed to see no one from the ESF is on their programme. This seems to be true to their form of dodging flak and to antagonise their customers, i.e. the parents of the kids sending their children to the ESF. We should say that we did invite the ESF to join us today, but they declined. Also, an email from Andrew. He says, one of my children studied IB, won A-levels at an ESF school in Hong Kong. As an educational experience, IB is far superior. It's broader, asks students to think more deeply, especially on the theory of knowledge paper, demands social service and creative arts. A-levels, by contrast, allow students to study no humanities or foreign languages after the age of 16 if they take science, and no science or maths if they take arts subjects. This is a disastrous narrowing at an early age. A-levels fail to discriminate students with real ability from rote learners. The number of students gaining full marks on IB per year can be counted on the fingers of two hands. Those getting three A's in A-levels must run into the tens of thousands. A-levels are devalued and incredibly narrow. IB should take over from them everywhere, including the UK. That comes from Andrew.
Dr. Codrington, when we go back to the idea of universities accepting, British universities certainly accepting the IB and the points they offer to prospective students, in your opinion, are they taking into account the extra work and duty which the IB demands? And I think you've mentioned already the many hours of community action and service work the students have to complete if they're going to be awarded the diploma. It isn't just an also-ran. You have to do this rather extensive and exhausting work, as well as write an extended essay of something like 4,000 words. Now, how are universities able to take that into consideration? Do they shave off a couple of points when they're making an offer?
It depends on the university. I think the universities, particularly in the US and Australia, recognize those extra components, and that's one of the reasons that they give extra recognition for it. The British universities tend to focus much more on a subject-by-subject analysis, which makes it more difficult for them to take those broader things into account. I mean, you mentioned the extended essay. Every student has to do 4,000 words of original hypothesis-based research in an area that interests them. They're learning how to manage their time, do footnotes, research, bibliographies. All the skills that universities take for granted are developed through the extended essay, during which the student has one-on-one supervision. It's wonderful preparation for university. That's one of the reasons I believe that when students go to university, they just fly in a way that students with other forms of preparation can't do.
John, if they can't get to university because the universities are demanding too many points, that skill is somehow being wasted, is it not?
Yeah, I really think the issue of the number of points is exaggerated. Every year, I can only speak of my own experience as a school principal. Every year, we're sending students to the UK. Virtually every student that applies for a university in the UK gets the university of their choice. And that's in a school that does nothing else but IB.
But you specialise, and therefore you're probably getting very good results. Whereas, let's say, ESF schools, where many of which are just starting down the road of IB, haven't had that benefit, and their children who are probably maybe struggling with the IB aren't getting the enough points to get them to the university of their choice, whereas if they'd just done their A-levels, they would have walked in. That's their concern, I would have said.
Sure. I mean, it's not my place to comment on what's happening in ESF schools. And with what quality. What I can say is that I am absolutely convinced that the IB is no disadvantage. A student who puts in the work, either with IB or with A-level, will get to where they want to get, as long as their choice is realistic.
Mr. Switzer, there's a story in the South China Morning Post this morning saying that IB is having, a mixed take-up. There are some elite schools that have decided not to offer the IB, or three which are scrapping or shelving plans to offer the IB. A couple of them say that they might consider IB as an option. What's your comment on that? Is that possible? Can you have IB courses running in parallel with others?
A lot of schools tend to run the IB diploma program as an alternative to, say, whatever is the case in the national system. So in a lot of the IB schools around the world, and here in Asia, we have a number of schools for which the IB is but one pathway for students to demonstrate success and to enter tertiary education. So it's not that one can't do it. Again, it gets back to the philosophy of the school and what kind of students that the school is trying to cultivate and foster in the community. So I wouldn't want to say, you know, well, they should or they shouldn't. It's really the school's choice. And if the school is interested in the IB, then we're interested in working with them.
Dr. Codrington, perhaps one of the final points we can make this morning is that what about the teachers themselves? Teachers who've spent most of their lives teaching GCSE O-levels or A-levels and now having to teach the IB, obviously it's important for them to have training. How much training is needed? How difficult is it to make the transition?
It depends on the teacher to some extent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been head of four IB schools, three others outside Hong Kong before I came here. In many of those schools, I was involved in the transition from the local program to the IB. Yes, it does require some professional development, but for many teachers who have perhaps become stuck in a rut and are reluctant to move beyond their comfort zone, engaging in professional development where they're exposed to some of the best educators in their subject area in the whole world, and learning how to network with teachers from other parts of the world, different cultural backgrounds, is often the most invigorating and exciting thing that could ever happen in their careers. Yes, there is work involved, but, I mean, anything that's worthwhile involves some effort, and I think this is a good example of that.
One more quick point, Mr. Switzer. Eve says, can we have something on IB for SEN children? Is there any IB course or equivalent or whatever that for special education needs?
Of course, and I think one of the assumptions I think people make about the IB and the diploma in particular is that it is limited to a certain kind of academic student, and I believe that the reality is far more to do with the motivation behind their learning. And if students are academically motivated, they shouldn't have any conditions placed upon them for any special education needs. So we do have a special education needs department, and we can work on amending and working with different assessments for those students for whom they would require perhaps some alternative assessment to demonstrate their knowledge. But clearly, students with special education needs will be accommodated, and it's a lot of it is a combination between what the IB can support, and then of course what the local school that's implementing the IB can support as well. So it's a combination, but I wouldn't want any student or any listener out there to think that the IB is only for a certain group of students.
Okay, well, John Switzer, thank you very much indeed for joining us. He's head of regional development at the IBO based in Singapore. Thanks to Stephen Codrington. Dr. Codrington is principal of Lee Po Chun United World College. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And staying on indeed.